apparently. Okay, well, we'll have to run for a couple of seconds anyway, so let's not worry about that. This isn't exactly addressed to keep a trick, so I wouldn't worry about sound quality or anything like that. This is Dr. Peter Morris from the Centre for the History of Chemistry interviewing Willard Arthur and Donald Green from the Standard Oil Development Company. Now, Mr. Green, you mentioned in your memoirs your recollections of MIT. Now, of course, you went to MIT in a very important period when Warren Lewis was building up a tremendously important school of chemical engineers, and you also mentioned Norbert Wiener. Is there anything about these two men that you'd like to sort of mention that you haven't mentioned there? Well, what would your impression of them?
Well, Doc Lewis, of course, was a consultant for the Jersey Company many years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very dynamic figure. You had him, of course, and he was a very interesting man, a very capable man, a lot of originality.
Yeah. Did he have any influence on your career? I mean, did he sort of address, did he point you in any one direction while you were a student?
I don't think I could say that he did.
No. What about later years, when you were working for Jersey Standard yourself, and he was a consultant?
Well, I had some contacts with him then,
mm-hmm.
and it was, but not too many. He was more involved in the petroleum end of Jersey's business than in the chemical.
He made many inventions in the petroleum field, particularly in catalytic cracking using the fluid technique.
Mm-hmm.
He and Dr. Gilliland produced some very fine ideas and gave us some great help on fluid cracking using the catalytic technique.
So what was your recollections of Dr. Lewis?
Well, he was a very dynamic man and very inspirational, I found him, over the years. And he always had ideas. And they came out spontaneously, and he had tremendous enthusiasm.
Would you say that he had a material effect on the research for essays? In terms of quantity?
Well, I think that he had quite a lot of influence,
yeah.
I think he did, yeah. I think that Russell and Murph were much impressed. And even before them, Mr. Howard, who was the head of Planet Oil Development, got a lot of help from Dr. Lewis.
Mm. Of course, Howard himself was a mechanical engineer, wasn't he?
Right. And a patent, and a lawyer.
What was your recollection of him, Mr. Green, of Howard?
Mr. Howard?
Mm.
Well, I admired him. He was very far-seeing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He recognized just about 1930
mm-hmm.
or earlier that this country had to get into synthetic rubber.
Mm-hmm.
The price of rubber kept going up and down, goes from nickel a pound up to $1 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And rubber is very important to the automobile industry, which uses gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got into the electric arc project, because that was the only way known to make butadiene for the genotype rubber.
Okay, what would, to what extent did Frank Howard direct the direction in which the standard oil development company move. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that, for example, the electric arc process, was that very much a personal desire of his own to move into those fields?
Well, I think he visited the IG and was much impressed by them in the late 20s.
Yeah, well, 26.
26, yeah. 27. Mm-hmm. And he was tremendously impressed by them.
Right, right.
And then they trotted out this synthetic rubber that they had, which was a very good quality at that time. Mm-hmm. Rubber.
What was your personal impression of John Howard? I mean, when you first met him, what, in 1930?
Yeah.
And what was your personal impression of him?
Well, as I say, I admired him a great deal. Mm-hmm. I think he was sort of a cold person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little.
As far as his personal relations go. Mm-hmm. But,
so would it be true to say that Frank Howard never received the backing from Jersey Standard as a whole, that he perhaps felt his ideas insufficient to him? But I get the impression that to some extent he was going ahead of the pack and he didn't always get the
credit. Well, I think they gave him a lot of support in dealing with the IG in the early days in 1920. Mm-hmm. 27. I was in Germany with Mr. Howard when we met with the IG and visited their plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mr. Teagle and other people from the from New York came over and had several meetings with the IG Farben and cooked up the beginning of a deal with IG, because we were very impressed with their work and mm-hmm. and their technique and their equipment and the way they were going at things. So we wanted to get their help.
Yeah.
And also, you have to realize at the time there was a shortage of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And La Follette was predicting that the price of gasoline was going to go to $1 a gallon then,
mm-hmm.
and that we were in for a big shortage.
Yeah.
So there was a possibility. And we visited their synthetic oil plant,
yeah.
which made oil from coal,
yeah.
in Wyandotte. Mm-hmm. And we saw the possibility that this would be the way to avoid a oil shortage in the United States.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we wanted to get their background on handling oil and coal and converting them into usable petroleum products.
Yeah. But we were thinking perhaps, no doubt true, but I was thinking perhaps of a somewhat later period, maybe like 38, 39, 40, when we were trying to persuade the government to develop synthetic rubber, but he's not always the wholehearted support of the company for that.
Well, I think he still was getting their support.
Yeah.
I think the trouble came after he ran into all the difficulties with the government on the IG connection.
Right. Mm-hmm. What would he be asking to that public attack on his motives, I suppose, is the word? I mean, were you very surprised by the warm thought?
I think I mentioned him there that I heard him say once that he felt that the company shouldn't have agreed to that consent decree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he felt that, well, that was perhaps the remark that maybe to bring up the comment about whether he had full support. One thing I've never quite understood, really, but he left the Standard Oil Development Company, I think in 1945, didn't he?
I don't know just when. Yeah, he was made a vice president of Jersey at that time, possibly that time. We can check the date if you want to know, but
I was just interested in a way and how his career at Standard ended, because I've never really heard a great deal about how his career ended. It's sort of we read about them. Mm. I suppose it's partly the fact that his book came out in 1947 and that ends in about 45, but I've never really known much about what happened to him at the end of his career.
Well, it's a very touchy subject, and I would say generally that with all the troubles that happened and the bad publicity that Exxon was getting, they got a little cool to Frank Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before that, they made him a vice president so that he could, have more status and prestige when he was dealing with foreign groups.
Yeah.
But then, after all the troubles, 47-48, then I think he ran into trouble with the people who were at the top.
Yeah. Let's move on a bit, or rather I should say back a bit, because you talk about the fact that you met Edgar Murphy at Sobey, Edgar Murphy. I get the impression when you write about him that here was a person who hunted after theoretical physics, because he always seems to have been very keen on theoretical physics and knowing theoretical physics. Do you think that perhaps, given another opportunity, he might have gone into theoretical physics? Or was he happy with something like that?
Well, I don't know, I don't think so. I think he was more of an engineer, but he was an engineer type.
Mm-hmm.
But he used theory to help the engineering.
Mm-hmm. He seems to have been a very remarkable person. I mean,
well, he was. He was. Mm-hmm. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
He was a real scientist.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's the one thing, is there perhaps one single thread that runs through his memoirs, which is the influence and importance and extraordinary quality of the person. Could you expand upon that at all? Is there anything else that you'd like to mention in that respect?
About Murphy?
About Murphy, perhaps about your personal...
I worked for Murphy when I was with Allied Chemical.
Right.
Which I mentioned him.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the job of expert of duty.
Mm-hmm.
Connection with his IG problem business.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered me a job, and that's Tracy and Bob Carey. He was a team. And we were in Elizabeth for a while, getting going on the gas station and designing the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And we all went to Baton Rouge.
Right, right.
And the Lambert plants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I guess he became head of the laboratory down there, didn't he, at one time?
Yeah. When he came up.
There was a laboratory down there that was mainly working on hydrogenation.
Right.
As a result of this
mm-hmm.
material that we bought from the IG Farmer.
Okay.
And there were three hydro plants under construction, and I went with the company. I guess I mentioned that.
Talk about it coming out more, I think, in the 50th year volume of the XNR&D, where the hydrogenation plant was clearly used for a variety of other processes, like the oxide process at the patient plant. But how did Murphy come to be connected with the Manhattan Project? Because, I mean, he wasn't, to my mind, at least an obvious candidate to be a professor.
Well, he was an outstanding engineer, and he knew a lot of people who were connected with the Manhattan Project, like Urey, for example. He had a lot of contact with Urey and other people, like Costum and the people like that, and so it was quite natural for them to pick him up and get him to work for the Manhattan Project. And he of their meetings and did a lot of work for them. He disappeared for a few days from work, and he worked on the theoretical aspects of the fusion process that was used to make uranium.
Mm-hmm.
He worked out the basic equations for the diffusion. And then he was interested in centrifuge approach, and we did a lot of work on the centrifuge approach.
Right, right.
But he had other people working for him on the fusion and hexafluoride to make the separation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Carl Cohen, the inventor.
Yes, Carl Cohen, yeah.
Yes, it's interesting in a way, because he is clearly, in the history of chemical engineering, a key figure, yet it's perhaps indicative of a lack of respect or recognition that chemical engineers get, which is probably for your average high school student or even university student, far less well known than, say, you.
Well, it's the same old story that the scientists get a lot more publicity than the engineers do. That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mercury was called to Washington, after Sputnik.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They called him a missile czar for a while.
Yeah, he was a missile czar.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Trying to straighten out the missile program and get our...
Yeah, it's amazing the way that there's a calling in for jobs quite unrelated to petroleum technology. Yeah. He didn't die young, but he died at a relatively young age.
Yeah, 1952.
And what position did he hold at that point? He would have been to your best friend itself.
Yeah, he had, as I recall, he had been taken over to New York and was the vice president.
He was the vice president of Exxon
at
that point, in charge of the sort of scientific vice president for that.
Okay. I see, he worked wise still particularly on the scientific side.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Of course, I think Clifton Garvin was the first chemist to become, or chemical engineer, to become president of Exxon.
Yeah, sure, that's right.
Well, we've had a lot of people from the production end of the business as president.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's move on a bit to some more.
We had a lot of chemical engineers from MIT on the board for years.
Yes, I was thinking of those within the company, I suppose. Let me just talk briefly about the ARC project, because I'm, of course, very interested in the ARC project. And I've done quite a lot of work on the pros and cons of using the ARC project, but of course the ARC project has had a bit of an unhappy history in the sense that it got used in Germany in 1940. It worked pretty satisfactorily during the war, but after the war, although various high temperature processes were on the market, nobody, I think with the exception of one Italian company that used it briefly, no company has ever got invested heavily in the ARC process.
Well, it's finished over the Hills, did
mm-hmm.
huh? The Hills.
Oh, right. That's right. Oh, yeah. Well, I've been there and I've seen it, but that, of course, is purely a result, a result of the fact that it was installed there back in 1940. And I think they themselves would agree that had they not had it, they wouldn't have installed it.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Well, at that time, all they knew, the only way they knew to go to make synthetic rubber was starting with acetylene.
Oh, yeah.
But a few years later, they realized, and of course we realized, that the problems of butane and butylene were part of a lot of things.
Actually, funny enough, I'm really thinking of it more in terms of in comparison with the carbide sector. You know, and here, and whereas I'm assuming that we're talking about acetylene, and here I'm just trying to compare the arc process with the carbide process or other high temperature processes.
Well, we compare them a lot. We thought the arc process was better.
I think one of the big problems of the arc process, well, as I understood it, there were three basic problems with the arc process. The first thing is that you get a lot of carbon black deposited in the...
Not very much.
But then, mm-hmm.
just enough to cause a little trouble if you go right into the compressors afterwards without rushing out the garden side. But that was not a real major problem.
And I think that's good.
We had this plant at Baton Rouge.
But that's basically why I'm sort of bringing this up. The second problem, what I heard about from the German end, was the fact that the process does tend to produce a certain amount of vinylacetylene and divinylacetylene.
Diacetylene.
Which are explosive and therefore
explosive.
Can cause problems at the refining end.
Well, it didn't give us any great problems. What we did, in the Baton Rouge plant, we washed the odd gas with oil and took out the heavy compound. And then we used the natural gas that we treated with the arc to strip out those materials. So we didn't really have any problems.
We didn't have any problems with that. And the last problem is not really so much a problem as much as a balance. But although the process itself probably uses only about two-thirds as much electricity as the carbide process per ton of acetylene, you lose a lot of that advantage in the refining phase. I mean, at least when you get carbide acetylene, you can use it directly, whereas with your arc acetylene, a refining stage, a purification stage, is necessary. Is that a fair comment?
Depends on what you're going to use it for.
I see. So you were, the Baton Rouge, of course, I don't think you tried to refine it very much, did you?
We washed it with oil and got out these heavy compounds and we got out the carbon black. Then we converted the dilute gas to acetaldehyde.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a very good process. It was a solid catalyst.
It was
impregnated on pumice.
A lousy
proposition. Yeah. But anyway, and then we would form cuprene. We formed cuprene because there's a little copper. Outside of that, the mercury process could have been used. Was the usual process, using mercury and ferrous sulfate and all that. But it was kind of messy.
When I put the phone to Hall, I think they made two comments. Firstly, they felt that the consumption of electricity was still quite good, even when one took the refining into account. But one also has to consider co-formation, co-production of things like ethylene, which they felt something could separate the ethylene.
Who were you talking to, did you say?
The engineer that commuted the vessel hall.
Yeah, do you remember who they were?
I couldn't offhand. I put the point to the company. Well, after that, I gave the company a copy of my thesis, and it was one comment I made was about the electric balance, the balance of electrical power used by various places.
Well, this was fairly recently that you talked to me.
Oh, yes, about 3 or 4 years ago.
You wouldn't know anybody there now. Rico Engel has retired, I understand. He was the head man.
Yeah. I think one of them was called Martin, but something, I'm not a first name, a second name, but I can't I can't now recall.
Anyway, they are reported that although the figures are quoted by electricity were not inaccurate, that they didn't take any account of co-production. That you know, the co-production of ethylene, for example, wasn't important.
Of course, using ethane or propane consumes a lot less power than using methane.
This would be a good point to say, if you'd like to elaborate, obviously in your memoirs you didn't want to be too technical. You can be as technical as you like here. Would you like to sort of just briefly set what difficulties you had in developing the art process at Baton Rouge?
Well, the first difficulty was the carbon black, which was washed out with oil. The Germans hadn't told us about that.
No.
You developed out of Baton Rouge.
That was rather a surprise to us. So we just put in a couple of towers and boiled through the stuff out.
Yeah.
And we went to reciprocating compressors, if I remember. Yeah, reciprocating compressors, which have valves in there. And the valves can just plug up the carbon black. But that wasn't too bad.
But when you say... When you say it wasn't too bad, am I going to understand that you didn't ever have to put the tubes out of action between them?
Between the compressors?
Well, I think the actual arc tubes themselves. The point being is that the Germans had a deliberate policy, in fact I think still have a deliberate policy, of putting some out of service to the clean.
Well, we had a spare arc. We had two arcs. We used one at a time. But the arc itself didn't have to be cleaned.
It didn't have to be cleaned,
But the flame tube would burn out once in a while.
Confusing two different things here. And the tube burning out, and also, of course, the carbon black potting and the compressors and so forth. It should be possible down on the slope.
Our main problem with Baton Rouge was in the acetaldehyde plant, where this catalyst was a lousy catalyst and it gave out a poor efficiency. And it became obvious that it wasn't satisfactory. So I was sent over to Germany to look at their plant. For converting acetylene to acetaldehyde using this mercury process. And then when I came back, we built a pilot plant and we worked it all out. And we felt we had a process. Then of course the acetic acid plant was fine. We had no trouble with that at all. So we reached the point, I would say about 1939, 38, that we could have built a big plant. But the economics didn't look too good.
You obviously helped to solve the carbon black problem. I mean, you could even go as far as say you solved the carbon black problem. Did you give the results of that to the Germans?
Sure. We had Germans right there.
Paul Baumann and
His crew. We had three or four good engineers.
Did you see the article he published a good few years ago now, about 10, maybe about 65 or maybe around that time, the article he published in the House Journal about my year in America?
Let's see, I got a couple of things that you
I don't remember that.
It's about time to seem to pay back this,
is it?
Why about that just right now? We do have a copy of that.
You have a copy.
We'll have a copy of that.
What help did the Germans give you in developing the process? I mean, apart from actually being there and working with you, did any sort of great help come over from Germany? I suppose Mercury's process is probably the best example of the technical help that you got from Germany.
Yeah, we got. I went over and I got the information that was necessary, and we built a pilot plant, and it worked. And it's a good thing we didn't build a big plant, because handling mercury is a lousy job.
Yeah. What were the plans? I mean, at the time we're talking of now, you know, 32, 33, so forth. What the ultimate aim, as far as using it in Germany, was concerned? I mean, it was in connection with the synthetic rubber work.
Mm.
I mean, there was no intention to use it for other kinds of acetylene chemistry. I mean, obviously, I know you can't separate the two completely, but it was specifically with the synthetic rubber work in mind.
Well, that was considered the main purpose of the work, but I'm sure the Germans were interested in other uses for acetylene.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they got into this,
That was a bit late. That was really slightly later. And Standard itself, I mean, what did Standard? Standard was basically interested in the process as far as using synthetic rubber as well.
That was our only interest. We weren't interested in selling acetic acid and all that sort of business.
I think the impression from some historians, and I couldn't tell you whom just offhand, but I got the impression from one or two sources that Standard simply developed the art process at Baton Rouge simply to show winning. But they themselves...
To do what?
Well, just as a sign of goodwill, as it were. You know, in other words... But
goodwill. Goodwill for the Germans?
For the Germans, yes. I mean, but it would never any serious. Well, I get the impression, I think Sam Howard to some extent gives the impression, but it would never any serious intention to use the art process in America.
Well,
what do you have to give the Germans a favour? You know? Mm. Quite understandable.
Well, we reached a point where we recognised that the art process was not the way to make synthetic rubber.
But before that, by
1935, that was pretty clear that that was not the way to do it.
As early as 1935.
Yeah. And then, as I mentioned in there, we got off on the dehydrogenation of the important.
Let's wait on my ground.
So we didn't do anything to...
Okay.
To make the Germans feel good, any object there.
Okay, fine. That makes better sense. Yeah. What was your impression of Paul Bauman in this period? How did he enjoy his stay in America?
Well, he was one of my very best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Always, ever since I've known him.
Mm-hmm. And did he enjoy?
I taught him how to drive an automobile.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did you? Mm-hmm. But this is one of the differences between America and Germany in that period, if I was right.
Well, he came over here in 1930, about the time Beller came, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives in this boarding house in Elizabeth, where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his wife and little daughter there. And we got very chummy.
Yeah, yeah.
I taught him how to drive a car then. When I went to Germany in 1933, he went with me. The two of us went to Germany, and I got information on Knapsack and other things too.
And what
Bauman was. Was the guy that was conducting me around, and I talked to a lot of the laboratory people on various new projects that they were working on.
Right. You got free access.
Then I had free access.
Mm.
There must have been about 10 or 15 different projects. I would talk with the chemist, and Paul Bauman would then write a memorandum.
Right.
To have it on paper so that I would get it straight and I would take the memorandum back to the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was no hold up on information at that point.
No, no. Well, perhaps that's also something we can come back to. I was interested when you said in your memoirs that Paul Bauman was interested in chemical engineering in America. And this is very interesting because there's been a great deal of work done lately on the fact that there hasn't really been any development of chemical engineering in Germany, but chemists are supposed to be able to handle the things done here by chemical engineers. Whereas you yourself have just come from one of the great centres of chemical engineering.
Yes.
Did you sort of perceive that difference at the time?
Yeah, it was 100% different.
Mm.
But they really didn't have any chemical engineers.
That's right. Well, even now, I think
they did things by cut and try.
That's right. Mm. Do you think that that was a great weakness on the part of the German chemical industry?
Well, yeah. It probably was, but they got along all right.
Mm. But you feel that probably had that.
See, when I saw some of the plants that made soda ash, for example.
Yeah.
I just worked for Allied Chemical on the biggest soda ash plant in the world, you know.
Mm.
What the Germans had was kind of childish.
Mm. It's childish, yeah.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, when you were in Germany, did you get the feeling that the engineering was sometimes choppy? You know, was not up to the same high standard you would have expected it back in Moscow?
Well, I think they were pretty good. With machinery, I think compressors,
Nordbrück
compressors, and all that stuff.
But perhaps that's an indication of the fact they were done by mechanical engineers. That in other words, the things that were done by mechanical engineers were fine, and the things that were done by chemists were fine, but the indefinable something in the middle wasn't so good.
Well, Bauman was very interested to see how we did the engineering, and he sat with me. Observe what I did when I designed the equipment for the aldehyde plant and the acetic acid plant.
Right.
I designed the equipment completely, even the heat exchangers I designed.
Right.
I think the German chemists used to downrate the engineers. I've heard them do it in the plant.
Right. Yeah. But we're almost up to point with control of general interest, but let me just ask two other quick questions. The first thing is, in your memoirs, Mr. Green, you say that the actual arc itself is the temperature of the sun. Well,
5,000 degrees is what the Germans said. 5,000 degrees centigrade, Celsius.
Yeah, but I think that's a bit lower than the temperature of the sun.
No, and the surface is about 5,000 degrees, maybe 6,000, for that point. Inside, of course, it's 95. I don't know how many thousand degrees it is.
But we're talking about the temperature we're talking about is 5,000 anyway.
Yeah,
fine. And how do you think that the arc process compared with other forms of porosity of hydrocarbons, like the real chemi? Do you want it the real chemi process where you have the fabric regeneration of fabric?
We looked at some of those in later years, and the Wolf process.
And the Wolf process is what I was thinking.
Yeah. And the Wolf process, I don't know whether it's still used.
I think it's dying out. What about the Tachesh process? The Tachesh process, where you have actual burning of hydrocarbon in situ. I mean, the BASF process.
Mm-hmm. You mean with oxygen burning, burning hydrocarbons?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
But, of course, one interesting thing I should perhaps say is that I visited the German, at all. When was it? 1980. And the interesting thing was that the arcs are still the same arc. The equipment in the arc house is still the same equipment. It was installed in 1940.
Were they running the arc?
They were running the arc.
In 1980 they were running
the arc? Oh yeah, they were still using them now.
Where was that?
In Hull.
In Hull, sure.
Mm. But the equipment was vintage 1940. I mean, there was a great deal of Bakelite on display. You wouldn't expect in the modern times. And the equipment was massive. no question of militarization. The main thing I noticed was just the tremendous noise of all the... There was a great deal of knocking. No, a great deal of knocking noise.
The compressor,
I wouldn't like to pin it down, but it was certainly the noise in the art house itself. Tremendous.
I guess there was a noise, but I...
Of course, you've got to remember there will be about 12 going at once.
Yeah.
In this case, you know, but I know they had this particular one which they had altered, so they could open it and show you the arc inside.
Yeah.
Now, perhaps I could just simply ask a general question at this point about your impression. I know this is a very big question, but your impression about the IG Farben plant and the thing that the Ludwig Farben laboratories, which I know impressed Frank Howard so much when he thought of in 1946. I mean, just feel free to sort of...
It's a fascinating place, as you know. The way they worked there was different from the way we worked. They would have little teams working on projects. Bauman had, he had four engineers working under him, maybe he had more, but working on this art project. And Beller and his crew was working on the oxidation of paraffin wax. But then they also had groups working in competition with each other,
with the same
objective, but working out different processes.
Now this is a very interesting point, because there was a study made about 15 years ago in Britain, which tried to claim that there was this deliberate quality of competition between laboratories. In other words, at any one time, two laboratories would be working on competitive processes. And now, I find that interesting, because in my own work, I tended to feel that a lot of this competition arose not through some great team to have this competition between laboratories, but just simply due to the fact that if Ludwig Harmon was asked to do some work on synthetic rubber, Leverkusen would say, hang on, we've been doing that for 10 years, we're not going to give up our work on that. So they would say, okay, you carry on with that and we'll see how you get on. To me, a lot of the competition, although obviously it was competition, was really an attempt to classify established interest in each of the laboratories rather than some great master plan.
Well, I guess so, but I was thinking that within the Opal laboratory there, there was competition between groups.
Even within the laboratory?
Yeah, within the same laboratory, yeah.
I see, but that would be...
And they knew that the people working, and the groups knew it, and it didn't bother them. They were good friends.
Can you give a specific example of that? That would be very interesting.
Well, I was trying to think. Well, on the acetaldehyde example, I was told that somebody that took files on that, but I don't have the file, but they were working on a method using zinc chloride as a catalyst to convert acetylene to acetaldehyde.
Okay.
That's a certain kind of catalyst, I forget what you call it.
Well, zinc chloride to make acetylene to acetaldehyde.
Acetylene and water.
Zinc
chloride.
Funny enough, a couple of
things. That was supposed to compete with this solid catalyst.
Right.
I can give you an example. In Opal, there was a Dr. Müller Conradi, who had a little group working for him, and they came up with the polymerization of isobutylene to make a polymer known as polyisobutylene or had other names later, and when Mr. Howard was on one of his visits, they showed him a sample of it. But here was a separate little group working on this thing. And one of the reasons they did this, you know, they were very anxious to get the patents in their own name.
Right.
There was a competition for patents,
right.
Recognition in IG that was very important.
That wasn't the case in Echo.
Well, we had people who were competing to get patents, all right, sure, but
not in the
it was a little different because they got sort of remuneration, you know, for their achievement.
Mm.
They got a share, they got some kind of a little share in the results of the process.
In Germany?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you've raised two interesting points there, which I would like to deal with just briefly. The first of which concerns the patenting of isobutylene, because I've read in Howard and elsewhere that Murad Kumrabi and his group achieved that, I think, in the spring of 1932. Oh no, it must have been even earlier than that. When did they first polymerize that out of it? But it must have been about 27 in fact.
It must have been earlier than 1932, because I think we had a pilot plant to develop the process here at London, you know.
It might have been much earlier than that. But the thing was that someone was asking me about this, so he could put it in a picture upon him at hand, Herbert Marvick, I don't know if you've ever come across him. Anyway, I brought this point up with him, and he asked me for the patent. Which is very reasonable.
Yeah.
But when I went to Chemical Abstract, the earliest patent that was signed was about 10 years later,
in 1936. Well, it only takes time to get the patent issued, you know.
Well, I'm talking about years. Yeah. 10 year gap there, it seems.
Well,
anyway, one other point.
What is your point on the
still money, of course, for the batteries and everything? Yeah, so the other thing I wanted to ask about Murad Kumrabi, because did you ever know him well?
I knew him quite well.
Did you know him quite well? But he's a bit of a mystery character, because...
I took him to Baytown, Texas once, on a trip.
Right?
Well, you weren't there.
No, I wasn't there.
But it was very interesting. He was a very nice guy. I liked him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What kind of person was he? I mean, what was his position in the IG, for example?
Well, I really...
really hard to tell. He had an elevated position, but
right.
You couldn't exactly tell where it
was. Perhaps he's one of the strange things about him. There's two strange things about him, I found. Firstly, is that, although he was very important, I mean, he had quite a lot to do with the synthetic rubber program in the IG. I mean, if you look at minutes of a rubber conference, or even patents, that he had clearly an important but sort of elevated position. I say elevated in the sense that I suspect a lot of the patents for which he is quoted as co-inventor, he was just simply the group leader.
Yeah,
you've got to say it,
yeah.
No, not the real inventor. But anyway, leaving that aside, if you talk to the German developers or look at the German history of the project, you will find him very much downgraded. I mean, you know, he's mentioned only when necessary, like, for example, giving the co-inventor of a patent. You won't find him touted as a prime mover.
He was not really the inventor of this polyisobutylene.
Of course.
Another fellow.
It seemed to me he must have been reasonably important.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
He made a special trip down to Baytown, Texas, and I took him down there.
Right.
And the chief engineer of Humboldt, Ernie Voss, and I... took care of him, and Ernie showed him all over the Humboldt plant, showed him everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't go for any special reason, as far as I could see.
No.
Just wanted to get a general idea of the way we do things in the oil industry, yeah.
The strange thing was that he died in 1945.
Oh, he did?
And I've never been able to find out, I know this kind of funny thing to say, but I've never been able to find out how he died, which made me wonder whether it could have been true, given the date.
But the other strange thing is that he is downgraded. I mean, there is a definite unwillingness. I mean, I've said to people, I mean, one of the first things I thought of when I went to Germany is I've got to find out more about this person. I mean, I knew quite a lot about some other people, including some which might be regarded, in inverted commas, as disreputable. But I never ever heard anything about him, and everybody, and when I mentioned it to people of that generation in Germany, they always said, ho-hum, he wasn't terribly important, let's move on to somebody else quickly. Yeah. but the other thing is that why I really wanted to know more about him was that between 33 and 34, and 33-34, he was this connection, he was the sort of avenue of communication, if you like, between the company and the government regarding synthetic rubber.
So was it?
He was the one who wrote the letters. I mean, I'm just saying, he was the one who wrote the letters. Now, that seems curious for someone who was in charge of an ammonia laboratory. Especially, okay, I know the ammonia laboratory, I'll find out a lot to do with another. But nevertheless, even within the IG Farben framework, he seems far from being the obvious person.
Well, where was he located? At Opal?
At Opal, yeah.
But the synthetic rubber was Leverkusen.
Oh, quite. I mean,
project.
Opal had a bit to do with it. It wasn't the most major bit for but, I mean, Opal did have a bit to do. I mean,
Dr. Ambrose was quite important on the synthetic rubber, and he was around Ludwigshafen with us when I was there.
Oh, quite, quite. Dr. Ambrose is someone I want to speak about in a moment.
I'm sure he does.
Well, for one thing, but in 33, of course, he wasn't that important yet. It was really sort of 34, 35.
No, he wasn't quite that important. No, but he was an important man. I could tell that.
Yeah.
I went out with him socially,
you know,
with a number of people there.
Of course, you were somebody who refused to meet me.
What year was that?
Well, I was living in Germany in 31 and 32.
Mm-hmm.
The one story I heard about him in Germany was that he got on with, you know, he rose to rapid prominence. Of course, he was the youngest director of the IG Farben when it ended in 1945. He owed his rise to power to the fact that he married the daughter of the factory chief of Ludwigshafen.
Yeah. The reason I brought up Müller Conradi and the polyisobutylene was that, you know, that really led to, helped us inspire our people to make butyl rubber.
Oh, quite, oh, quite.
Okay.
Well, in fact, we could mention that briefly, because, of course, the Germans made the great failure, from their point of view, of never introducing the diene.
Yeah.
Now, there's two questions there. The first question is, why do you think they failed to do that?
Because they're interested in GRF.
I see, right.
GRF. That was their life. They weren't interested in butyl rubber. But even when it came along.
Yeah. In 1938, Vermeer came over.
Yeah.
From Leverkusen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he was that big synthetic rubber man.
Yeah.
Right. He came over, and I think Russell talked to him about, well, I was in the same meeting, and butyl rubber was mentioned.
Yes. Yeah.
But he didn't have any interest in butyl rubber at all.
No interest.
Well, this, of course, incidentally, I may say in parentheses, but I gather Camille was very fond of America.
He was?
Very pro-American, I gather. But anyway, that's an aside. Now, were the Germans offered butyl? I mean, were they offered the formula for butyl? So, of course, this is one of the sore points in the whole question of whether time has helped, I agree or not. I have something comforting to say about that point, but were they actually offered the formula for butyl rubber?
Well, did you read, you read Mr. Howard's book?
Yeah.
He talked about it in there, doesn't he?
Yes, but my memory now is...
What did he say?
Slightly rusty about it.
I thought he offered to them at one of the meetings, but...
But they weren't very interested.
They weren't interested.
Well, I can state categorically, having studied the German record, but they never used it. And the reason why I'm making this is because it's one of the four things which Dan did it all accused of in helping the Germans.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that the Butyl was never of any... The only thing they knew probably butadiene for was, as you say in your memoir, that an additive to things like polyethylene and stuff like that.
Polybutadiene?
Yeah, polybutadiene.
Polybutyl or polybutylene?
Which one do you mean? Polybutylene?
Polybutylene, yeah.
That's
right. Well, I mean, they did use it, but only for a very small... but that's not like a rubber. The point is that that's not butyl rubber. That is non-diene additive. But had an interesting process for making it, as you probably know, because they filled, they mixed it, as I think you did, with liquid ethylene. And then they used the evaporation of the liquid ethylene to cool it down to the right temperature. And as it was evaporating, it flowed onto a coat, well, I should say, from its point of view, a hot plate, but from point of view of the engineer, the cold plate.
So there was ethane they mixed it with, I think.
Rather
than ethane.
And then there was a scraper that went along, scraping it off.
A peculiar apparatus.
That's right,
yeah.
But it already made a very small amount, I think something like 1,000 tons a year.
Well, you know, one theory is that the reason Mr. Howard offered them Duna rubber is to try to get them to move on Duna rubber.
Oh, that's quite fine.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, we won't have time for that now. But, that was a point we could perhaps come back to. So, I'm still trying to get some idea. I mean, I've already got a very good idea of what the IG research effort was like, but what were the attitudes of the people working in that research effort? I mean, was their attitude very much one of, shall we say, academic researchers transported to an industrial location, or were they very hard-headed about the truth of their research? I'm talking of the sort of people at the...
Well, they were
the bench, as it were.
Well, they were very interested in making a success of their work, of course.
Yeah.
But I went over there in 1933 for several months.
Somebody at the door. Well, I guess he's delivering them the mail.
Money?
Money?
He went over in 33.
Yeah, Hitler had been in a year
when
I was there. But the chemists I was in contact with were anti-Hitler.
But what about...
And they were pretty frank about it to me.
Interesting. But what about but the people you're talking of are, I suppose, what you might call relatively low-level people. I mean, can you give a specific name of someone? I suppose Paul Bowman would be a case in point. Can you name anyone else of that same level who was on synthetic rubber, for example, who had this plant and the nasty attitude?
Well, Hans Beller. Did you ever hear of Beller? He was involved in the paraffin oxidation.
But what about the attitude of those higher up in the company?
Well,
I'm thinking of not so much the senior, you know, the very senior people, but people like Ambrose, who then went on.
Who was the head of the laboratory there?
Just to shift over to the lab where I was, Dr. Peer was the head of the hydrogenation laboratory where I was.
Dr.
Peer.
P-I-P-R.
He was the top expert on hydrogenation. And they're doing a lot of hydrogenation work of coal and oil there in that most laboratory. And I had the feeling from discussions with him that he didn't care for the Nazis.
Despite the field he was working in.
Some of his assistants, like Dr. Ringer, you probably read about Dr. Ringer, he turned out to be a very pro-Nazi before he got through.
Thank you.
He keeps it going.
It did get into the Verbunen process, though, you know, the butane acrylonite trial, oil resistant rubber, which competes with neoprene.
Right. I mean, it had a value, had a good commercial value. Yeah.
We did get into that, and we started up a plant in early 1941.
Right.
Bad news.
What did other people, what did people outside the company think the America were going to do if it was cut off? I mean, were they going to rely purely on the stockpile of natural rubber?
Who would think that?
Well, I'm trying to get at it, but what did the American government and the American people think they were going to do if they were cut off? That's what.
The American people couldn't have cared less.
No. And the government doesn't care either.
No.
I mean, it's a question of no thought being given to it at all, rather than an alternative.
Well, Frank Howard would go down to Washington time and time again and talk to him, you know, but didn't get anywhere.
I mean, to what extent was this lack of interest due to the fact that they felt that Stan did had a vested interest in getting
well,
into
it? Could have been.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't, I suppose, have been practicable for Standard to have started up on, you know, to say, to heck with all this, and to have started up its own program, you know, really big program.
Well, you could, you see.
Yeah.
We couldn't get into the manufacturer
right.
and expect to sell this stuff.
Right.
Because you'd have to sell it for a much higher price than natural rubber.
Right.
Yeah. Just like the problem with the synthetic gasoline now.
Right, quite. But on the other hand, I mean, I'm just trying to be a double advocate to some extent. But you could have argued, well, Sam, you could have argued, well, we're definitely going to run out of rubber. Yeah, the chances of being cut off are very great. We can make the stuff. Okay, we'll make the stuff now. By the time we get going, the rubber will probably be cut off and we'll be able to make a lot of money out of it.
Well, we couldn't tell it'd be cut off. Couldn't be sure when. But we weren't interested in getting into the rubber business.
I see.
But the Verbunen was different. That was a special product sold at a high price.
Right. So how did you do with the rubber companies? I mean, did that not bring you into potential conflict with the rubber?
Well, they put up their own Buna end plants.
Yeah, well, of course, it was a famous case of
Goodrich did, and Firestone did.
Yeah.
I don't know about Goodyear, I forget.
Yeah. What about Americol? Because, of course,
Goodrich,
which standard regarded as an infringement of its patent rights. Would it be true to say that Goodrich was being deliberately provocative by trying to make capital out of a political situation by introducing Americol, do you think?
I would be surprised.
I mean, my impression was that they produced this rabbit out of the hat to, you know. From the standard point of view, I mean, the rubber companies I know felt that standard would be unnecessarily uncooperative in not giving them licenses to make something like that. Well, what's the standard standard like?
I don't know. Can you
answer me? No, I can't. I really
can't. I mean, my impression is that standard didn't really have the technology to give them.
Not to me. We didn't have it complete now, but we developed a process for making GRS.
Yeah.
And we had a capable man working in the laboratories by the name of Byron Vanderbilt, who developed the process. He got a lot of help by reading the IG patent application. He made that at first.
In November
1939,
he started his lab work directed to Verbunen.
Who was this?
Dr. Vanderbilt.
Oh, right, yes.
And then the following May, I think it was, we had a pilot plant running at Baton Rouge.
Oh, right.
On the coast. We designed a pilot plant while he was doing his lab work.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, we had a commercial plant running at that.
Right.
It was only 5 or 10 tons a day. But
okay. It was better than nothing.
Yeah, but a couple of these other rubber companies were, they might have been a little bit behind it. I'm not sure. I think you're
right. Well,
you realize that later, under the auspices of the rubber program in Washington, there was a technical committee set up to exchange information on synthetic rubber.
Yeah, the exchange, the so-called exchange agreement.
Yeah, and Vanderbilt disclosed to them the results that we had had in the laboratory.
Yeah.
And I think our formula was adopted by them.
For GRS, you mean?
For GRS, I'm sorry.
But I gather, and this is a very interesting point, I think, and one that hasn't been made explicit before, is that when you say that, of course, you were developing Perbinan and GRS, BRS, yourself, we're really talking about an independent development by standard. I mean, you're not getting any input from the IG side at all. All you've got is a CRISPR patent. I mean, in terms of practical hands-on information, you're not getting any information from the German side at all, even in 37, 38. Is that right?
Dr. Beller did help by letting Vanderbilt read the patent application before the patent had issued. So he got an advanced look at what was going in the U.S. patent office. And from that, he got a very key ingredient out of the whole thing on modifying the GRS reaction. From a chemist standpoint, you should be interested in that. The addition of mercaptan.
Well, I know Miller Sweeney.
You know Miller Sweeney?
No, I haven't met him yet. I know he did a lot of work on modifiers.
Vanderbilt was the main man.
Well, Vanderbilt, of course, is still alive. So he's one.
Oh yeah, he's alive.
One person I'm hoping to interview.
Maybe better. Sure.
Yeah. He just had a 50th wedding anniversary. So.
Yeah.
I got a card from him the other day.
Just to tip on a little bit, in your memoir, you expressed your surprise when you were still struggling along with the pilot stands for butyl, and you were just beginning to see light, only to be informed by the management that there is a very prominent crisis match butyl to the government for the synthetic rubber program.
Say the last part.
Well, but you know, when you were working on the butyl plant in Baton Rouge, and you had just got the whole thing going, when you've been told that you have to double it all again.
Well, the thing, the plants had worked pretty well at Baton Rouge under the conditions for which it was designed.
Right, not to say enough.
But then suddenly, our management told the government that we could triple the plant capacity. Were you in on that?
No.
Decision?
No.
Good thing.
So that obviously came as a great shock.
I think what happened was that Howard and Murphy were down in Washington. And made that suggestion based on something they had seen done in the lab a day or two before. On his speakers,
I suppose the company felt under pressure to come up with something good.
No, that wasn't the reason. The reason they made the proposal was because there was a shortage of strategic steel. Alloy steel, chromium nickel steel. Which we needed for the low temperatures. And it was a problem to get those, and if we got them, somebody else would not get them. So Howard thought that, let's be really patriotic and make this proposal.
How did that fit in with the steel, right?
Well, because we could cancel one or two of the plants, not build them at all, see?
In other words, what you were really saying was, sorry, I didn't really quite grasp this point before. The proposal was not so much to expand production per se, but to argue that with the same plant they could produce more.
I need fewer plants, fewer units.
That's it.
We were talking about building another big plant at Baton Rouge as big as the Baytown plant. See, that was three times as big as the little plant.
Right, I see.
So that was cancelled right away.
Oh, I see. I'm fully appreciated, but it was an expansion capacity which was promised.
That's an important point.
Ah, I see. Point, yes, obviously. So, how did this breakdown in communication occur? I mean, did they just feel on the spur of the moment that it was something they could do?
I don't know. I wasn't in on the discussion.
But in fact, of course, did that create great problem? I mean, is that part of the reason why Baton Rouge never worked as well as it could have done?
Of course, that was a good part of the reason.
Okay.
Because as soon as that decision was made, then we had to try to run the reactors at three times the rate they were designed to run. So they plugged up much faster.
Much faster.
And we didn't have spare reactors to have time to clean them out.
Yeah. Right. Now, to anticipate a bit, that will presumably not a problem they had at Sarnia, for example.
No, they didn't try to get this high production.
They started out and
everything went fine.
So in a sense, that by trying to increase the production like that, they did the whole thing about turns, really. But in fact, probably you could have gone to over capacity, but without, you know, you could have probably have got what you might call spontaneous over capacity if you had not been forced to try and increase.
Yeah, well, that's what happened at Sarnia. As the years went on, their plant made more and more.
That's right.
They still had the very same equipment that we had in the first unit at Baton Rouge. Yeah.
While you were sort of bogged down on all the problems you had. Right. There were conflicts, you said in your memoir. You said there was a conflict between the Standard Oil Development Company, for which you worked, and the Baton Rouge regulars, who, if it were, more or less insisted on running the show themselves.
I don't say there was any conflict there.
Well, perhaps you say that you came
they
down.
They put a different
you came down to Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
And then you found that the people at Baton Rouge had more or less taken over control of it themselves.
Well, when I went down there, as I said, the plant manager told me that this is your project. You tell them what to do. But in the meantime, the government plant. This is a government plant. Were set aside in a separate organization, so the cost could be kept separate, and the people kept separate.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are running that thing, Dan Patch.
I
was in charge of it. He didn't know anything about chemicals. He couldn't care less. The way I felt at the time. Well, I shouldn't say that. He's recording. But anyway, that's the fact. So they didn't do what I wanted them to do.
And that caused
for one thing. So that caused, it made us very unhappy. But the main trouble was that we tried to get three times the capacity out of something that wasn't designed for it, and the local laboratory people may be suggesting you add this or change this and all that, and every time this was done in the plant, had to shut the plant down, make the change, and then the operators of the plant had to switch around to other units so that nobody got less money than he was supposed to get. So he got a new job, and the ones that came back to the plant when it started up needed to be trained again. So that happened about three times. So that's why Baton Rouge was so slow in coming up to production.
But wouldn't that be, I can understand your problem from that point of view, but wouldn't that be a problem that would exist on other polymer plants as well?
Other butyl plants?
Well, yeah, other butyl plants have it in PRS
plants. Well, changes weren't made in those plants the way they were in this plant.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, what, put it another way, what was unionism pretty strong at Baton Rouge? Was stronger at Baton Rouge than say another part of that song?
I don't know. No, I wouldn't say that. No. Not at the time.
I think you have to realize that the Baton Rouge refinery had a lot of new projects coming in, new catalytic cracking units, new rubber units, everything popping up. And as soon as a new unit came in, they had to start shifting workmen around.
I see.
And it was a question of seniority. Then you see the senior people would get a shot of the new plant. And that caused frequent disruptions in our labor force at the rubber plant, rubber plant. New people had to come in and had to be trained, you see. It's a careful process, had to be run carefully. And
what's the difference between a tubular reactor and an annular reactor? I mean, that's an invisible what a tubular reactor is.
Well, a tubular reactor.
Well, if I can remember. Had a lot of tubes in it, I think.
Okay.
And there was a pump here. And stuff would be pumped up here, come back through the tubes.
Right.
And then go up again, see?
That's it.
In the annular reactor, we made it longer to get more area, and it looked like this, as I recall. Still had the pump. But we didn't have a lot of tubes. We had annular. Something like that.
No, the water, I see. So you got to the water go around the wall.
No, not water. This was methyl chloride with the rubber in it.
I see. So the varying description of the reactor really referred to the arrangement of a water pipe.
Not a water pipe, but the... no water in it.
No, of course not.
You mean the fluid pipes.
The fluid pipes,
yeah.
I see. Now I see it. So you mentioned about this point Paul Fleury, who helped you out with some of the problems you had with people. You've also said before, quite correctly, that Paul Fleury didn't work very long in the wartime project. Do you have anything about Paul?
Yeah. The way he helped us. I was interested in the theory of polymerization.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting reaction, the Buhler reaction, that takes place instantaneously.
Right.
And I wanted to get some idea of the effect of concentration of the reactors, temperature, and that sort of thing.
Right.
On the molecular weight of the product and the unsaturation in the product and all that. See?
And weight, molecular weight distribution.
Yeah, that's right. So I talked to Paul.
Who, of course, was the ideal person.
And he was an expert in that field.
Right, quite. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he gave me some ideas on how to get some data, or how to correlate the data. And figure the thing out. So I got Dr. Joe Nelson, to make laboratory tests where you take a small conversion so that the liquid concentration didn't change much with conversion. And on the basis of his data, Ed Marshall and I worked up these correlations which were used to run the big plants. I don't know what they've done since then, but I know those correlations were used for years. That's what Paul did. But then Paul worked under Per Froelich, and in the Exxon system, usually people work in what they were told to work on. Well, Paul Fleury had his ideas and what he wanted to work on. And I don't think his ideas matched what his bosses thought.
No. No, I think when you went to Goodyear, in fact, you got a promise you could spend time on your own problem. But what other work did you do at SO? Do you know anything about the work you did?
I don't.
No, I don't either.
He worked in the lab, but I'm not sure.
No, I'm not sure.
What else he did?
So, did he strike you as being someone who was going to win a Nobel Prize?
He was a very bright guy, yeah. Mm-hmm. I liked him very much. I was quite impressed. But I didn't think of a Nobel Prize.
No.
At that stage, gee, that was 45 years ago.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how old he was then. He was born in 1910, so that would make him 33.
Yeah.
Of course, by that time, he was a very public devil.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely important.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, definitely.
So he used to get together and his wife and play bridge.
Yeah. Were you very good at that?
I don't recall.
I just wondered whether brilliance in one field can be easy compared to another. But and basically, I suppose you didn't really have an awful lot to do with in the labs on the most part. I mean, given what you said about Paul, that you really only called on them when you really needed help with the problem. And did you do that? You didn't do that all that often, I gather. Did you have much to do with
No, I didn't have anything to do with it.
No, I
never got in contact with it.
I see. What were you doing in this period? I mean, I'm not having a set of memoirs because...
Well, what period do you want to talk about?
Well, we're talking now about what, sort of 42, 43?
Well, I came back...
excuse me, I'm taking my medicine.
I came back from England and after the war really got underway and when I got involved in working at Linden on a lot of coordination projects connected with synthetic rubber and aviation gasoline and things like that. I was working as an assistant to Mr. Murphy. And one of my problems was to contact the authorities in Washington, like Rubber Reserve, and every morning, every Saturday morning, I would get on the phone and talk to the people in Rubber Reserve as what was happening on the rubber plant, and act as a liaison with Washington. And then I was following the research work too on a lot of the projects, making aviation gasoline and the synthetic rubber projects too. So I was sort of in an administrative position. Sometimes I would go to Baton Rouge and spend time at the rubber, at the Utah rubber plants too, working there. And I had some pretty hard nights there too. I was essentially an assistant to Mr. Murphy.
Oh, I see.
During
that
time.
So you worked with him throughout that period, yeah?
Yeah.
And until when?
Well, in 1947, of course in 1945 I went to Europe with the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey.
I did too.
And we visited a lot of the plants. I was in the oil and rubber section.
Oh, I did that.
And we operated out of London, and we, whenever an opportunity arose, of course, we'd go into Germany and look at the plants that had been liberated by the armies and see what we could find about the bombing results.
Right.
And we put out report called the Bombing Survey Report in 1945 of what had happened in Europe.
And what particular plant did you visit?
Well, I went to Ludwigshafen, of course. I went back to Ludwigshafen. And I got into Leuna just before the Russians came in.
Oh, right. But of course it was liberated by the Americans.
Oh, the Americans had already liberated it when I got there.
But of course also liberated Skopau.
Yeah, I was in Skopau too. I visited, our team visited Chemischewerke Hiltz and a number of plants like that. The Germans had kept very careful records of the bombing of their plants day by day and of what had happened to production.
Right, that was very convenient from your point.
And how much bombing had ended up outside of the plant, they called it agricultural bombing, and the size of the bombs used, And we passed some of that information back to Washington that the larger bombs seem to be doing more good. And I wasn't there all the time. I was there for a while. I was there in I was in Hanover when the war ended with the Germans. And
Must have been a bit what kind of an experience was it to go back to somewhere like Ludwigshafen or Leuna where you'd seen it in 1933?
It was pretty bad, you know, it's pretty bad. And we'd see some of our friends, and I talked to Budapest and Leuna. He told me about the bombing and how serious it had been there. I went to Leuna with the purpose of getting information on nitrogen, synthetic nitrogen plants in Japan. In Japan. Because I think the plan was to use that information in any possible bombing of Japan before any invasion. And I got all this information, and before I left, the man I knew had gotten me this information together in one day. And he said, "Now I got to ask you a question. What do I do tomorrow? The Russians are coming in here tomorrow. I can go. I can stay here and work for the Russians, or I can go with the Americans. They'll take us out of here tomorrow night in a bus or a truck. Load us into a truck with one bag each, and they take us to the American sector. What do we do?" I don't know what he ever did. I don't know. I never heard from him then.
You weren't able to take anybody with you?
Oh, no.
But,
you know, it was a terrible feeling to realize that here was this land that the Americans had liberated, and the damn Russians were coming in the next day.
But let me just ask you one question. I'm a little bit worried about the tape, and I'd like to try and get this on paper or something. I am writing a paper at the moment, actually, about the German use of synthetic rubber before and after World War II. And one question I would like to address myself to is if the Allies had started early enough and knocked out the synthetic rubber plant, whether it would have made much difference to the end of, whether it would have shortened the war, kind of been a little bit of policy, or given that it was only two for most of the war, whether knocking both of them out would have made things very difficult for the Germans.
Both oil and rubber, you mean?
Both oil and gas power. If they had been knocked out, say, in 42, would it have made a radical difference to the war, do you think?
At that point, I don't think so, no. But, the Allies were bombing hell out of those plants. And we would, his friend Bob Carrier and I would go down to Washington and look at the bombing pictures and see what had happened to the plants after they'd been bombed. And then, of course, you could tell if you saw a lot of steam coming out, you know, they'd gotten this unit or that unit back.
But you don't think sustained bombing of the plant would have made things... You don't think that sustained bombing of the...
You know, I think we did a lot of bombing. I think we did probably as much bombing as we could with our available personnel.
Of course, you made a very good mess of Hull, of course, because it was knocked out for 6 months in 1943. But I was just wondering whether it had to be able to knock out.
But the thing was, we found from our photographs that the Germans were rebuilding them so fast. They had an organization under Speer, I guess. They were rebuilding them. And the first thing you know, you see steam coming out of some unit. And you knew that they were back in operation. I think the more sustained bombing would have been fine, but I don't know if the Allies could have mustered the personnel to do it.
Okay, let's just stop there. session divided farming in 1933-34. Perhaps you might like to just go over briefly what kind of research projects you discussed. When you were saying that you got a detail of something like 15 projects?
10 or 15. I really can't remember.
Okay, fine. Can you were actually worked in Germany for a while, didn't you?
Well, I was a contact man with IG Farben and in Ludwigshafen, and we're getting hydrogenation information. I was a contact man and passing the information back to Exxon.
And what period were you in Germany?
1931 to 1933.
You know, the bombing of Hall will probably be as great as it could have been. There was no sustained attempt to bomb Stokow until about 44.
Uh-huh.
That may have been part of the distance from Bow.
That's a long way. But of course they were bombing Lena.
Yeah.
Regularly. They bombed Lena fairly regularly.
But only after July 44.
July 44?
That's when Karl Spatz, I think, is an objective, but they bombed it. Because the Speer, this is now a very famous comment, because Speer, of course, publicised it.
Yeah.
But Speer, I think they first bombed Lona on the 5th of July, 44. And Speer wrote, and he died the next day, that now the Americans are doing it right. If they carry on doing this, we're finished.
Yeah.
No, it's not his argument, but the Americans could have been doing that from 42 onwards.
Well, we were urging the the Air Force, through what contacts we had, to bomb these plants.
Mm.
And we were telling them where the plants were and what they were making, because we knew all of that before the war.
Mm.
And the British were doing the same thing. The man who worked for me in London was with the bombing people in London, and he was doing the same thing, trying to pick the right target for them.
That's the right time. Mm.
I think there are a lot of bombs that didn't hit the target.
Oh, yeah, and a little bit of bombs.
A lot of bombs hit the agricultural community around and didn't make the target.
That's right,
yeah. Yeah. Mm.
But even so, I mean, Hall was out for 6 months in 1943, which was probably the single biggest blow to the synthetic rubber project.
Right.
In fact, it was the only time that the synthetic rubber project was mentioned to Hitler during the war, but they actually told him that they had completely lost production and that something would have to be done about it. You didn't work on the Fiat at all, you only worked on the bombing survey. You never worked on the field intelligence
team. No, I just on the bombing survey.
Were you involved in the intelligence work at all?
No.
Okay, let's move on a little bit here. Could we get hold of a copy of Rubber for More, by the way? At the centre, we'll be quite interested in seeing the film. You know this film that was made about the Bootow project?
I don't know where it is.
Yeah, except Paul Smith might know.
Paul Smith?
Yeah. He's at Clinton.
Yeah. You know Paul?
Well, I'm going to meet him in a couple of weeks' time. I gather he is ultimately our paymaster, the chairman of the... We're run by the ACS.
I'm sure
And he's the chairman of the board of directors.
Well, you could ask him. He could probably hand it up.
Yeah.
It was a lousy film, but anyway.
We'll be interested to see. What did you think of the people who paid? What did you think of the actor who paid you?
Not much.
Did they try to make it too heroic, or
no?
Mm-hmm. What was wrong with it, though?
I didn't think he looked like me.
Oh,
I wasn't a very important character in the film. Not as important as I thought I should be.
Because
I was the guy that suffered through the Baton Rouge agony.
These other
guys didn't.
Well, perhaps you address an almost similar question. But several times in your memoirs you mentioned the question of morale. But it's very difficult to get chemists or chemical engineers to work on something full blast for 3 or 4 years. Then for the company to turn around and say, well, that was a very bright idea, but we've now decided we're not going to use it. Or alternatively, perhaps even less inescapably, you work on a project for 3 or 4 years and then find that with the art project, for example, that it just isn't really patentable. Did you find that morale was a big problem with doing this kind of research?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a big problem, but as the years went by, I don't know, we got kind of tired. We got to the point where we had to work 9 hours a day, 6 days a week. And that's pretty tiresome. And we didn't think that we were treated right or bad in movies. We didn't think that, that the top people understood
the problems that we made about that. I mean, that I suppose partly arose because Standard wasn't a chemical company. Therefore, didn't that have anything to do with their lack of understanding? Because Exxon wasn't a chemical company, it might have been less well understood than, say, the chairman of DuPont might have understood it.
Well, Jack Rathbone understood it. He became president of Jersey later on. And he was sympathetic.
But I'm just interested in this question of morale because, you know, you often read about research and the problems of directing research and the problems of getting the best out of researchers, yet I think very little attention is given to this inevitable problem which must arise with morale. But in the sense that, obviously it would be very foolish on the other hand for a company to actually push something through just to keep the morale up.
Well, I think there was a morale problem in the chemical division where the chemists would work on things that looked promising to them, but the company wouldn't follow up on them.
And that means it's obviously difficult to keep key workers.
And of course, there's no use spending a lot of money on research in some projects unless the commercial people said, yeah, we'd be interested if it works out. And of course, we had a number of projects where they said, well, we're just not interested.
And to what extent do you think, with hindsight, their judgment was sound or not?
Well, one of those things was a synthetic detergent. We could have...
that was eventually licensed, I think, wasn't it? No, was it?
What?
I think somebody else bought a license for the detergent in the end, did they not?
No, I don't think there were any licenses involved. Chevron. Got ahead of us on the thing because our commercial people said, well, we're not interested.
On that very same line, what about Powerful S?
Powerful S?
You mentioned in your memoir yourself that the failure there was probably a failure of marketing rather than
Powerful S. The people who got interested in it were the Swedes. They found out how to use it to line cardboard to make these triangular packages. Which are now, you can see them advertised. Have you seen them?
No.
It's called a triangular package.
What do you do with them?
Well, of course, that wasn't a very big outlet.
But I find the question about marketing interesting because, of course, several studies of innovation have indicated that where a company gets high marks for research helps, but not crucial. Where a company gets high marks for marketing, that's sometimes better. But where companies get high marks for both, they're the companies that do well. I mean, I do Farley at the point.
DuPont,
IBM.
We were weak on that.
We were weak on the marketing. Well, that's an interesting case. Another thing about that period in your memoir, you sort of hint at the fallout from the wartime recrimination about the SOIG agreement, and of course in the background you had the wartime, the war crime trial taking place in Nuremberg of IG Farben. Was that a difficult time for the people who have worked on IG Farben related things before the war? I mean, did you feel rebounded on?
I never heard anybody in the company regret
doing
having worked with the IG.
Not what I mean, not basically. Did you ever come across?
Well, I personally was upset with all the bad publicity we were getting in the newspapers, you know.
Right.
With the various committees attacking us.
Of course.
In Washington.
But I mean, that isn't quite the question he asked, though. Was it?
Yes, that's right.
Is that what you...
Well, it's a mixture of both. I mean, it's a mixture of whether the public barrage made anybody in the company regret doing it, or...
Well, we were mad.
We were just mad, I think.
Mad at the Attorney General, at Arnold, whatever his name was.
Herman Arnold.
And that whole crew, and Truman, that Truman Committee.
We had to go to those committee meetings and waste our time. You know, we should have been working on the war.
Yeah.
So you testified.
I had to testify at one of these committees, too.
That's right. And was that a towering experience?
Yeah, it was a very, very exasperating experience.
Yeah. Well, I believe DuPont had similar feelings before the war, because there was this pre-war committee which investigated DuPont, I think the Bone Commission.
Yeah.
And I was very amused to see in this picture of DuPont that it was entitled Trial Without a Jury.
Yeah. I don't remember that.
No.
I don't remember either. But you know, we felt that we would be in trial without without a jury in trial.
Yeah. The one particular thing I wanted to ask about that. Let me just take on that point, because there were four accusations that one commonly comes across when talking about Standard and IG, and I think they're all baseless, but there's just one that I haven't really found the answer to yet. Now, if I can just go back a bit. But the accusations are like this, that Standard Oil hindered the development of synthetic rubber in America on the orders of our department.
Yeah.
That is a bald-faced lie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I mean, basically,
I think the guys that said it knew that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One also, of course, as you yourself explained, that Standard wasn't in any position to violate it because they weren't being given the information they needed.
No, you couldn't get it.
You can get it, that's right.
No.
And the second one, of course, is the application that Standard Oil gave butyl to IG Farben, which I would have known pointless because IG Farben never made any use of the information given.
Well, we offered to give it. I didn't think I said
no. Well, nothing would actually give
it. I don't think they ever got it.
No, never got it anyway.
Never got it.
No, right. So the third one is about synthetic oil, that Esso helped to develop synthetic oil processes in Germany.
You're thinking about the Fischer-Tropsch process?
Well, I think just in sort of general technical advice sort of thing.
Well, we gave general technical advice to the IG,
But on the other hand, of course, you probably got more information from them than you...
We felt we were getting a lot, and we gave them enough to get what we wanted.
Yeah.
We learned a lot about cattle
from
the IG.
Right. Mm.
One of the most important things we learned in the oil business was their information on catalysis.
Okay, fine. Yes.
Saved us a lot of time.
Yeah, fine. Just one, and this is the only accusation about which I know nothing at all, but one accusation that is made is that Howard, personally, rather than the company as a whole, they arranged, he couldn't do it personally, but arranged for IG to get a large treatment of TEL, that Germany was very short of tetraethyl lead in 39, and Howard used his influence with the ethyl corporation to get some ethyl lead for Germany. Now, this is the kind of thing I know nothing about.
I think that's mentioned in this book that you have.
I think so, yeah.
And
Now, it's an accusation I've never really found the answer to, but I'm quite sure.
It's part of the war book. Not the war book, the other one, up to 1950.
1950, yeah.
I was reading it yesterday. You have already seen it.
Yes. You have arrived, I don't have interest, sorry, that's too good before. Now, you raised the interesting point that after the war, and I was talking about post-war, But after the war, you were improving the Bhutara all the time. But at the same time, the Bhunaresh people, the GRS people, were improving GRS all the time. So it was a question of you sort of hitting a moving target, as you.
And we tried to get into tires, you know.
Pardon?
We tried to get you into tires.
That's right, yeah, that's right. And
we worked pretty hard at that.
Yeah. Thank you very much. As you then go on to say that not only were you trying to hit a moving target anyway, in the fact that you were trying to improve on a product that was improving all the time, but you also go on to say, very perceptively at the end of it, there was a bit of a hopeless struggle anyway, because you were talking about captive markets were essentially captive in any case. That the rubber manufacturers, because they were making GRS, weren't going to turn around and say, do tireless better. I know it's easy to say 30 years later, but why bother? I mean, it's given that you
Well, we thought Buell might make better tires.
Yeah,
you know?
It is.
It's possible that it might.
Yeah.
Because
they would have to be very much better, wouldn't they?
They really would, yeah.
I suppose you have the advantage of treatment, or wanting it treated by that stage.
What?
Well, at one time, Buell had a very high cost advantage over the GRS. I was wondering whether that cost advantage...
On paper, yeah.
But it has narrowed down a bit.
I understand Buell is doing pretty well for the company.
Yeah.
Still, after making a lot of chloral Buell.
And bromo Buell. But what about... If we could have, this is a speculation, but if one could speculate that GRS had never been forcibly developed during the war, and that research had carried on at something like the late pre-war tempo, where companies were developing things like rubbers but not pushing them through, do you think Bhutan might have become the rubber of preference instead of GRS, if GRS hadn't had that big boost during the war? Given it treatment?
I don't really think so.
You don't really think that GRS would have all won out?
I don't think Jersey wanted to get into the rubber company and companies and making tires and all that sort of thing.
You both visited Germany in the 50s, 53, 55, and you both visited Germany in the 30s. What did you find were the great contrasts, both in Germany and in the German chemical industry in those 20 years? I mean, obviously there's some pretty obvious contact that the Nazis were no longer there, but in more subtle ways, do you notice differences between the two?
I didn't see any Coca-Cola signs in 1933.
Well, what about the industry? What the retail?
Well, when I was there, and Bill too, that was the time of depression,
and
hard to get good food.
Right.
Go into a restaurant and you'd get rabbit. But I had a little trouble finding good meals in Mannheim.
Just before the war, you know, it was a real bad depression there.
Yeah. It was in 30.
33,
But in the 50s, this was before the economic miracle, really, in Germany, wasn't it, 55?
Well, 50s.
They were doing all right in 55.
They were doing very well.
I was back in the Ruhr in 55 in Essen, and Dusseldorf, and places like that.
Yeah.
And they were doing pretty well.
That's right.
But what about the industry? I mean, had the industry changed direction? I mean, my impression from my own work is that, you know, one of the great changes in Germany, or could you say West Germany after the war, is the way in which the chemical industry completely changed direction from being very much based on coal, directly or indirectly, to an extent, where one can see it is that the chemical industry was pleased about petroleum duties being imposed in 1928, and yet in 1953, they actually asked the government to remove the duties. I mean, that was the difference. I mean, can you...
I don't think the German chemical industry is really based on coal these days.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about in 33.
In 33, they're based in coal.
And right. That, whereas by 55, it was already becoming more petroleum based.
Right.
And did that lead to a difference in research outlook, do you think? Do you think it was very much the same research but didn't feed so?
Well, like in this country, it really was. Back in the 30s, our industry was based on coal.
Right.
Ammonia was made from coal,
right.
Not from natural gas.
Quite. That's true, but on the other hand, I mean, talking about it purely relatively, America was the great petrochemical producer before the war. I mean, it may have not been much, but it was enormous compared with either Britain or Germany. I mean, I think he already by, if I remember my figures rightly, but already by 43, they were producing as much ethylene in America as they were producing acetylene. Whereas in Germany or Britain, the ratio was then quite the other way.
Yeah, I think there's quite a change in the 30s.
Oh, yeah. Because of Union Carbide, for the work done by Union Carbide, do you think, or can standard claim?
Union Carbide? That's all.
Anyone else? Particularly?
Dow, I imagine.
Yeah. What about, for example, Indiana Standard?
Well, they weren't doing much in chemicals.
They weren't doing much in chemicals.
No.
No. Okay, fine.
Shell in this country, of course. But.
Yeah, fine. Let's just talk about the region. You talk in your memoirs about the research strategy in chemicals after the war, when the Exxon went much more definitely into the chemical field in trying to develop new chemicals. Would you like to say something about what the strategy, what the strategy of this move into chemicals was? What particular kind of chemicals were they looking for?
Well, that was always an argument.
But in 1955, we got a license from Professor Deeper to make polypropylene and polyethylene. And a lot of the research effort was devoted into those fields. And we built a pilot plant in Baton Rouge to make polypropylene. And I guess Baytown built the first big plant. But there was a big shift into polyethylene, polypropylene.
And up to that point, though, I think Exxon had been rather reluctant to go into
plastics. This was going into plastics.
Right.
Mm. Maybe 10 years later than we should have.
Right.
I mentioned that.
So what did the other people want to do? I mean, you wanted to make.
Well, we wanted. Murphy wanted to go into polyethylene.
Right.
But our commercial people said we would rather sell ethylene and take the place risk of trying to sell polyethylene.
Right.
So they sold ethylene.
But that wasn't so good.
It was all right. But then, along came the Professor Deeper, and his process was taken over by a lot of people, including Carbide in this country, and DuPont.
Right.
And this changed the outlook on plastic.
Right.
Really did. So a lot of our effort was diverted into polypropylene.
You, in fact, I think, were in charge of the negotiations with Giglio.
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
What was your impression of the setup over there? I think was it you who said that you were surprised how much they managed to do in such old-fashioned laboratories? What was your impression of
the work? Well, I was very impressed with the work, but was I impressed with Ziegler, who was working 20 years on aluminum compounds, And here it took 20 years, but he got his basic research in Heidelberg, got him into this field. And then his patent attorney didn't write the patents right, and Professor Mata came through with other patents and other work, but it was a big a really big developer, I think.
Now, when I was getting that minor appointment, their facilities were very meager,
right?
Both Nadas and
very
and Ziegler,
right?
Whereas these days in the U.S. or even then, big laboratories, you know, and all kinds of facilities,
right? So you got the impression that in the sort of technical front, in the sense of the quality of the laboratory and so forth, that the United States was pulling away from the European.
Oh yeah. More automated too, you know.
Right.
Our laboratories are more automated.
Right.
I've been in some laboratories in Russia and they look lousy.
Looked
like we were built them 20 years ago.
Oh, I see, right.
30 years ago.
So, of course, there was a great rush by all kinds of chemical companies to try and get into this field. I mean, just to mention a few, the Phillips, DuPont, Standard Indiana, and so forth. So why did Standard New Jersey decide to go into such a crowded field?
Well, it wasn't quite so crowded then.
I think Mr. Murphy is a man who got really interested in it when he saw that our friends in Carbide got into it. And he got the impression that we could get a license. So then I went to work to try to get some licenses for us. And then
from
I
Carbide.
I'm talking about Ziegler now. And of course, Carbide's come through with a new invention, you know, on the greatly improved low pressure polyethylene plant. I used to be very high pressure, but they're lower pressure now.
So what would Ziegler like to negotiate with? I believe he was fairly formidable in the sense that...
Well, he was difficult. His patent lawyer was even worse. But Ziegler was, I'm the big man here now. Everybody's coming to me for a license, and why should I give it to you? And I made a number of trips to see him when I went to see his lawyer and worked with his lawyer. But I had some help with me. I had a very good assistant helping me on this. He's since died.
Who was that?
Pat Wayland.
So you managed to get more or less what you wanted.
Well, we even got more than we wanted. We started off on polyethylene.
And then you got the...
And then he said, before we got through, he sent me a cable in New York saying we do have polyethylene too, a license. But of course, you know, that just meant we...
Polypropylene.
That just meant that we had to do a lot of work, though. We just got laboratory experiments, basic work from the laboratory, and we had to go and develop it.
Who was the person who did, I'm trying to remember who did, what is, who did the work, the experimental work in Standard? Was it Rabgood? I can't remember his name behind that. I know who it was, but I just can't remember.
Well, we had some inventors who invented modifications of the catalyst.
That's right, yeah.
I can't think of the name right now.
I really can't remember who worked in polyethylene.
Okay, we have it elsewhere.
Okay.
Now,
Merck.
Merck, it's become quite different from... is there a story behind that, or was that difficult to mention as well?
Why did he go? I don't know why he went, but I can guess.
Okay.
I think he expected to get a promotion that he didn't get, probably.
Yeah. But to mention something less controversial, I was rather amazed to hear that the original pilot plan for making butyl rubber consisted of a washing machine.
That wasn't really a pilot plant. This was just a thing put up on the roof
on
the laboratory building with a tarpaulin over it.
I must confess, I'm not a chemical engineer, but my mind rather boggled about how you would fit up a washing machine to make rubber.
Butyl rubber was made by putting in isobutylene and a little butadiene and liquid ethylene
all coming to the truth, presumably.
And stirring it up.
Yeah.
No, just dumping it in.
I'm just dumping it in your bucket.
Yeah, there's a batch process.
What do you call it? Propylene. So you feel that propylene is the next big polypropylene.
Oh, yeah.
It's the next big story, because apparently, according to him, not only do they have the longest patent battle in history,
right.
Which is now been going on for 30 years, no doubt. But also, apparently, it's got, you know, love affairs and murder and all sorts of other things as well. I don't quite know how would they come into it, but apparently he thinks it's so gripping that he would not only like to write it as a history, but also sort of make it into a novel.
Is he still working for Exxon?
Yes, he's just published a book on scaling up.
Where does he work in Exxon?
Clinton
Country.
I don't quite know what he sort of... He's basically some of that publicity. He worked in... I'm not sure. I think it's some sort of research coordinator.
Well, so Kant was right.
Yeah.
Well, I gather from Kant that Tabitha had already published a book when he was in Washington.
Who? Bisio.
Yeah, Bisio.
No, well, this book is due to come out about the Synthetic Lover project.
So this is something new that he's been...
Yeah, he's been working on it for 10 years.
Okay.
He did it with another gentleman who I don't know at all, and I've never really quite worked out how he fits into all this, Vernon Herbert.
He used to work for me.
Did he? Mm.
Vernon Herbert too.
Vernon Herbert's name figures in all this, but having met Dr. Bisio, I rather gather it's mainly Dr. Bisio's idea.
Well, neither of them were involved in synthetic rubber.
That's right.
Well, as far as I know. Maybe Bisio was, but Vernon Herbert was.
No, well, Bisio didn't know it enough.
That's interesting. Small world, isn't it?
Yeah. matter of fact, to be...
Okay, we're back on.
Back on.
Yeah.
Where were we? We're talking about... The strange greatness, no, that's a thing. You will find that very interesting. There's just one last thing on the particular side, on the particular query, and that is about fear. You mentioned at the very end of your memoir that you were afraid that the lack of innovation in Exxon were going to lead to problems in years to come. That was nearly 10 years ago. To what extent have your gloomy predictions come true?
Well, I haven't seen any startling things come out of Exxon research. Have you, Bill?
No, I haven't. Really?
On the other hand, could that not be related to a dark of exciting things coming out of many chemical companies these days?
Could well be.
I mean, I don't think that DuPont has really come up with anything that will kind of set the world on fire.
Well, I can't think of any new thing in recent years.
No. Outside the pharmaceutical field, I think there are some drugs.
Yeah.
Okay. But outside the pharmaceutical field, I can't... I mean, I'm writing a book called Polymer Pioneers, which are going to deal with 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, Hyatt, Ferroloid, Berthelot, who was a French chemist, but he said something about polymer. Pickles, who you may have never heard of, but Samuel Pickles, he was the first person to suggest that rubber might be a train molecule rather than a ring. Bakerland, of course. Then Carruthers, Marvel.
Of DuPont?
Yeah, Carruthers and DuPont.
Uh-huh.
And Marvel, Carl Marvel.
Yeah, I know him.
He's still alive.
Yes. And then Staudinger and Marx. Fleury and Kuhn, Werner Kuhn, a Swiss chemist. And Ziegler and Natter. And at the very end, they were going to write a bit at the end saying, look at the exciting things that are happening in polymer chemistry today, and then I rather fiddled out that most of the exciting things I could think of in the last 5 years would be impossible to explain to anyone without knowledge of chemistry.
Well, that's like music.
Yeah.
The best music was written 150 right. years ago, 200 years ago.
Right.
I don't know of very much music that's been written in the last 86 years that is worth much.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
What about personally, I would agree with you. I mean, I would feel that the best, the last notable composer was Bruckner, but...
Bruckner.
Mm. Or Brahms. Brahms died just after Bruckner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you feel that to some extent your predictions were right in the sense that you feel that Exxon has
well,
failed.
Well, I really don't know much except what I read in the press.
Yeah.
Well, I get their magazines and so on, but I don't read much that's new.
No. I mean, both of you are people who have worked in innovation in the chemical industry, had a lot to do with innovation in the chemical industry. How do you feel? I mean, do you feel that, do you sort of ever feel baffled that nothing is happening these days? I mean, that you feel that you've lived through a period that saw all kinds of new products, like synthetic rubber, low-density polyethylene and so forth, and you feel that, you know, that momentum hasn't been kept up?
Well, I don't worry too much about it. I know that Cliff Garvin has plenty of worry these days about the future of the petroleum business.
Yeah.
And for Exxon, that's the main thing.
Yeah, quite obviously, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So...
what are these fears now about where they're going to get it from next? Or
yeah, that's exactly it.
Just look at Exxon, as you see in the papers, Exxon is buying back stock.
Is it?
Buying its own stock.
Yeah.
It means it doesn't have enough new projects to
spend
the money on the way it used to.
Right. And also, in the case of Exxon, I would hardly imagine, I mean, I know a lot of companies are buying up stock to prevent... rapid, you know, to prevent sort of raiders. But I mean, I hardly imagine that T.
They're
Boone...
They're just copying Exxon, most of them.
But I mean, I can't imagine that T. Boone Picking can imagine that he can take over.
The other thing is that the petroleum end of the business is not expanding. In fact, it's being contracted.
Right, yeah.
And refineries are shutting down. We're shutting down big refineries in Hamburg, in
the one in South America,
the one in Aruba.
Aruba,
that's one of the biggest ones. And
one of the oldest ones too. It's been going for a long time.
Oh yeah. And as a result, we don't have the oil companies generally don't have the incentive to develop new petroleum processes because they're shrinking. Thinking back.
There's several different things. I mean, if we're talking about petroleum in particular, there's really several different things here. But namely, that except in the success of the processes developed in the 30s and 40s, but you can hardly get any more gasoline out of petroleum even if you wanted to. I mean, that would that not be. And secondly, that no one had had any success at that anyway, which is perhaps not surprising. And thirdly, of course, it was becoming less petroleum to use anyhow. I mean, what is this flow of petroleum these days? I mean, my impression is, and I'm not an expert on this, my impression is that there is a lack of the number of problem resources of petroleum are shrinking very rapidly. I mean, in other words, there's a whole block of petroleum out there, so to speak, which is speculative. I mean, what people think might be there, but less and less of it has actually been turned into real known petroleum.
Well, there's a lot of it in the Middle East, but who's going to control it 20 years from now?
Hmm? Even in the Middle East, I mean, I think it's running down, isn't it?
Well, that's running down too.
But
that's really the big problem of the petroleum industry, I think.
Yeah.
Where are we going to get gasoline from 20 years from now?
Even if
or what could a substitute be?
Yeah.
Hard to think of a substitute.
Mm-hmm. We think the problem is going to be as near as that. It's going to be, you know, 20 years.
Well, I don't know.
Mm. Well, I heard one time, about 10 years ago, everybody was mentioning 2000, the year 2000, mm. As the doom date. But my impression was it had been put off a few years since. But, you know, partly due to fall in consumption. But I was just wondering whether there were any sort of, I think we're pretty well covered most things, but it was just, I suppose, two things we haven't covered. That is the question to do with the growth of petrochemicals, because we haven't talked a lot about petrochemicals. What we have, we've touched upon it. But is there anything particular about the sort of the growth of petroleum-based chemicals between about, say, 1930 and 1960 that people have not tended to discuss?
Well, one would think that maybe there'll be a tendency to go to coal as a raw material for chemicals, like it was in the 30s and 20s.
So in other words, that you're saying that maybe in 100 years' time, 200 years' time, the petrochemical industry will be seen as some kind of bizarre interlude between...
Yeah, I think it'll be much sooner than that. Much sooner than that.
Of course, it's raising all sorts of problems, because, I mean, take the whole syn fuel question, the question of synthetic fuel, that when we had an oil crisis, the government said we're going to spend lots of money, much of money on synthetic fuel, but now, you know, the price of oil has fallen rapidly. The government, you know, from its own logical but short-term perspective, said, well, that wasn't a very good idea, so we'll forget about that. Yet, you know, what I'm really trying to say is that you can't keep setting up and shutting down a syn fuel industry every 5 years or so.
Well, you can't.
Huh?
You can't.
So,
when Exxon's got a new process they developed at Baytown for liquefying coal.
Yeah.
They've got a new process for that.
Mm.
And it was run on a pilot plant, large demonstration plant scale.
Yeah.
It was shut down now.
Mm.
There's no reason to use it right now.
No, it's not. Mm.
But that can be started out.
So, you know, it's on mothballs. Right?
Yeah.
Mm. So you must, you know, since you were so heavily involved with hydrogen making in the 1930s, when the whole fuel crisis started in 1974 or so, you must have, you know, felt a bit like old
time. Right. Here we are again. Deja vu.
That's right.
As I remember in the 20s, what is the estimated life of the oil reserves? 7 years?
7 years, yeah.
Something like that, you know.
Yeah.
And then along came the East Texas field in 28.
And then they discovered the Saudi Arabian field in 38. Yeah. So your main argument about the growth of petrochemicals will be that the growth of petrochemicals in a sense is going to seem rather odd in retrospective. That's going to be the main feature of interest.
Yeah, it's going to be a rough field. They're making these petrochemicals in Arabia now.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Tabit, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the feedstock is damn cheap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a lot of talk back in the sort of mid-70s how eventually, I think the Shah of Persia, before he, to me, was very fond of making this point, that one day in the not too far future, that the oil producers would have to make sure that the chemical industry got the petroleum rather than the fuel industry. And now we feel that, we'll put it this way, in an unregulated economy, especially
yeah.
one has in America or Western Europe, but it's going to be very difficult to, even if it were a good idea, to ensure that that happens. But I'm going to put it this way, if petroleum got so expensive that it was no use for the fuel people, it strikes me that the chemical people will probably be trekking back to coal as well.
First, they talk about the price of oil going down
for a while. Yeah.
Mm. But
I'm glad I'm not running Exxon.
I say, what about these chemical engineers? Because you're both chemical engineers, And yet we've touched upon the fact that Germany didn't have any chemical engineers in 1930. What do you see as being the sort of relative role of chemical engineers and chemists in the chemical industry? Do you see envisage a situation where chemists are going to be more restricted in their potential use in the chemical industry, or do you see them?
You have to have both.
Yeah.
But I think the tendency now is in the biology field, which certainly takes chemists and all kinds of professionals.
Mm.
But to make those things, you have to have engineers too.
Right. Mm. So you think for one thing there might be a sort of...
It would be a different kind of engineering.
Yeah, bioengineering.
Much smaller scale stuff.
But how different would the task of a bioengineer be from a chemical engineer? I mean, surely, although it may be living things, they're still very much chemical things. Now, I can't see that the task of a bioengineer, for example, is any greater than your problem with butyl.
I don't know. I think there are real problems in that field.
Yeah, that's right.
About that.
I suppose, anyway. One question I wanted to ask about butyl, and I forgot, was that it strikes me that you were saying that the reaction was instant, and you had to, you know, to even get a feasible reaction, you had to carry it out at very low temperatures. It surprises me in a way that there wasn't much research done on a catalyst that might have produce a slower reaction, which would have been more controllable. You know, could have, for example, been carried out at, say, room temperature, and with a reaction time a sufficiently long reaction time that you could actually sort of handle it better.
Well, maybe so, you could discover it.
Well, in fact, I think the Zeger catalyst, can the Zeger catalyst be used to make polyisobutylene?
Polyisobutylene?
Yeah.
Oh, that, you mean...
it might be.
Aluminum, yeah.
I think I have heard that you can't make a very specific group, but of course, there's a stereochemistry involved there. You've got a methyl
group. That's right.
You've got a methyl group, not a...
Yeah.
Okay. But the point was that strategy, feasible though that strategy may be, that particular strategy was never attempted during the war, or trying to produce a more handleable reaction.
Higher temperature?
A reaction
would be fluoride, didn't we?
Be an entirely different polymer.
Yeah.
Everything would be different.
Oh, I see. Right.
Well, you can use boron fluoride, there's other catalysts you can use, but the aluminum chloride seems to be the simplest.
Oh, I see, right.
And take so little of it that you don't have to extract it from the product.
Ah, well, that's probably an advantage, yeah. Mm. I suppose it's probably easier to cool a reaction down than heat it up, in terms of. But then, of course, it presumably must have been very sterile, been carried out at such low temperatures and at such speed. Presumably, it did have a great deal of stereo regularity.
Well, it's a.
I think it does turn out to be mainly stiff, and I can't remember. I read somewhere that
branched, of course.
Cut down to it. Mm. Even the paper, essentially, they wouldn't have expected branching.
See, from isobutylene, it has to be branched.
Oh, that is branched in that sense. I thought you mentioned the sense of branched chain. But, okay.
That's what I mean, branched chain.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay, well, it's not a major point, anyway. I'm sure they're right. I'm just wondering how that relates to what I'm about to do. Okay, is there anything that we feel that we haven't touched upon?
Do you think you've gotten what you wanted?
Oh, yeah, sure. I find it very useful. For one thing, I find it very useful. Well, I find it useful on two things. Obviously, it's always useful to talk to someone who worked on the synthetic rubber project. From our point of view, your work wasn't quite so useful because we were hoping to concentrate on Linden. To some extent, it would be more interesting to speak to Vanderbilt or Crony. But nevertheless,
Well, Vanderbilt was at Lyndon.
She was at Lyndon too, Vanderbilt.
That's right, that's what I mentioned.
Yeah.
So I remember that very viewpoint. I found it very interesting, your town talk.
Well, the fundamental work was done at Lyndon in those days.
Yeah. They're very, very
useful.
And what I found particularly useful was talking to you about what happened in Adelshaven, because I never met anyone outside Germany who had been in close contact with them. And the people, the company, of course, that haven't been put on, or the company as a whole, having been put on trial for war crime, everybody in Germany I spoke to about it felt that you could take off now, there's no problem.